In today's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with fitness trainer Jeffrey Verity Schofield. Jeff and I spoke about 5 tips for improving muscle gains, the issue with dogmatic nutrition approaches, and nutrition around the world. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Jeffrey, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating, or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Jeff. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa. I'm your host. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with fitness trainer Jeffrey Verity Schofield. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Thank you for having me.
It's my absolute pleasure. We were just speaking before starting to record and saying that you're actually in China. And I'm super curious to hear how you got over there. So why don't we actually start off with how you got to where you are today, physically speaking, but also in terms of your training career and everything else?
Yeah, so I've been here a long time. I've been here, probably about 14 years. Yeah. So pretty much my entire adult life, I'm 35 and a half or so years old, almost 36, actually. Yeah, so I've been here most of my adult life. And so it sounds quite exotic to a lot of people, but to me, it's kind of just normal. And I initially came here as an English teacher way back when, and I enjoyed that. It was good, but it was kind of something I got stuck in. Because there's not really a lot of career advancement being an English teacher, especially in a foreign country, because there's you can't become like the principal of a Chinese school. That'd be kind of cool, but it's just, you know, that's not really something that can happen as the foreign teacher. And so I kind of wanted to branch out from that. And eventually, at some point, I started lifting weights, and I enjoyed that a lot, and I had a passion for that. I still have a passion for that. And so I sort of tentatively started making that my job. I started coaching people sort of just for free at the beginning, you know, just giving advice to your friends, that kind of stuff. And you become the go-to person for fitness stuff, right? Or nutrition stuff. And eventually someone was like, man, this is really good advice. I should be paying you for this. I'm like, paying me? Now we're just talking about training. Like, and I was like, and so, you know, eventually he's like, no, like this is, I can already see the results. Like, this is really good. Like, I would feel bad if I didn't. And so I was like, oh, cool. Like, that's a thing. And so I slowly sort of got into that. I started running on Quora and then making YouTube videos, and it's sort of taken off from there.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you for sharing a bit about you. And I know a thing or two about being in a foreign country. I left Germany, where I'm originally from, about 15 years ago as well. And at some point, as you said, it just becomes kind of normal that you're not in your own country. So I can imagine. And I love how you've set yourself up there now with what really works well for you and with something that you're passionate about. And something that I love about your content is how you just disperse some of the myths out there and some of the fads out there and some of these all or nothing sort of messages that really try to polarize people and coming at it more from an educated and kind of neutral perspective. And I love that.
Yeah, no, it's I think it's partly human nature to be attracted to extremes and then also to be almost risk averse. And so the people who are like, don't eat this food. Oh no, never eat a banana, like that kind of stuff. It goes viral. And if someone doesn't have a base in nutrition, then they might not necessarily know who to trust or who to believe. Some things sound too good to be true, but people don't know it's too good to be true. And so they just think it's good, and really good stuff tends to do well online. And the same thing with training. It's either a lot of fear mongering or like, this is the best exercise ever. Like, this exercise, it'll blow up your back or something. It'll grow muscle better than anything else. And so, yeah, I try to take a reasonable, well-grounded approach to both training and nutrition, where I'm willing to try some extreme stuff, but I almost always just keep being drawn back to the center, just moderation, sustainable practices, because that seems to be what works best long term.
Well, and in the end, I think especially if some of these extreme things try to deny the laws of physics, that's where we're running into some problems, where someone is like, No, if you're eating this and that diet, you don't have to worry about calories. You can eat whatever you want. It doesn't matter. You're like, yeah, no, you can't really define, like, whether you're carnivore or vegan or whatever, you can't really defy the laws of physics. So, yeah, I guess talking about these two, since veganism not as much anymore, but carnivore diet in particular still is kind of like the bee's knees, whatever, of something a lot of people talk about. What is your take on either one of those, and what are some potential problems in your opinion that people could run into when following either one of those diets long term?
Yeah, so I think often what you're seeing is a pretty small subset of people who respond well to a diet, and then they become kind of converts to the. There's definitely a cultish aspect to both of those, maybe more carnivore at the moment. But there is this mindset of like of oh, we believe in this. There's this togetherness, like, oh, you're also a carnivore? I'm a carnivore. It's almost like this religious thing at some points to some people. And I think either approach definitely has drawbacks. And with carnivore, some people do get a lot of mileage from carbohydrates. I definitely do, right? I mean, I've done longer term fasts, 3 days with zero food at all, just black coffee. And I can still perform, but I do find that long term having carbohydrates in my diet does help, right? I think just for progression and for performance, for work capacity, the ability to recover, probably hormonally, at least for some people, especially if you're very active, meat is fine, but you can eat more than you can eat more than meat. And often the reasons for not eating meat, particularly vegetables, I just don't think are very sound, right? There's a lot of mechanistic stuff, or oh, this food has this thing which can prevent the absorption of micronutrients. It's like, yeah, but overall you're still ahead, right? Because you're getting in more micronutrients, or it's a mechanism focused mindset where, okay, yeah, it does have that thing, but long-term studies show that people who eat vegetables are healthier. So how do you explain the actual, as Lane Norton would say, like human randomized control trials? And so it's like they're looking at the mechanisms when we have better things that are at odds with what they're saying. And so if someone likes carnivore and they want to eat that way, I'm not going to stop them because it's not really my business. The main issue is when they're getting really preachy and making claims that are just not true. And they do. You don't see it as much with veganism. They're sometimes more chill, but sometimes they're also a little bit chatty about how they're vegan. Like I've met some vegans and they're just like, not always, but sometimes, you can't eat a meal with them without realizing, exactly how they eat on both sides, right? And so I think you can eat meat and also eat vegetables, and that's probably the best outcome for most people, right? And so, yeah, again, I kind of take a moderate approach to nutrition where I'm not leaving any particular food group out personally.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you on that, and I think for the majority of people, that's most certainly the most sustainable approach. Also, because I personally, I mean, if someone, I'm totally with you. If someone wants to follow one of these diets for whatever particular reason, go ahead. But once they say it's the best or it is better, then that's kind of the issue. And I think particularly with the carnivore diet, I'm cautious because we just don't have the long-term data in the sense of, okay, what happens without that fiber? What happens in terms of, like, I'm not so concerned about the carbs per se, but more the specifically the micronutrients and the fiber that we're missing from the vegetables and grains and so on. And likewise, a vegan diet can work really well, but you and I both know a vegan diet could be toast and jam and spaghetti, or it could be literally like plant-based with some with attention to protein and supplements where needed. And that's two very, very, very different things that we're talking about here. So yeah, people just have to always kind of be a bit more nuanced than just saying like, oh, veganism is the best, carnivore is the best. Yeah.
With veganism, yeah, with carnivore, it's not quite as much as a brand in order to sell people stuff. I mean, it'll probably go that way at some point. I feel like it's almost a little bit newer than veganism, but veganism, it is, I think, to a certain extent, quite big business, right? So there's like fast food companies making vegan stuff, but it's still not good for you, right? Because it's packaged, it's processed, it doesn't have a lot of micronutrients. It's perhaps very, very calorically dense, not satiating, less fiber because it has to stay on the shelf forever. And so, yeah, some people see something on there, oh, it's vegan, therefore it's healthy, but that's not even the biggest factor when it comes to deciding if a food is healthy. It's what is it being compared to, right? Like, yeah, there are certainly some vegans who don't really eat vegetables, which sounds wild, but yeah, there's a lot of not as much in China, I would say, but I've seen people where their diet is all packaged stuff, and you know, a candy bar is I don't know if it's vegan or not, but there's a lot of, like, I'm sure there are vegan candy bars that you can get. It's like,
definitely.
I
could even imagine that someday we're gonna see some like carnivore processed products, because it didn't take long for that to happen with keto, like keto ice cream, keto whatever. Yeah, exactly, money. You say it. But yeah, touching on the Chinese diet there, as you're mentioning it, one thing that I have always found, and I haven't spent a lot of time in China, mostly Hong Kong actually, but not outside of that, but what I've always loved is just the high amount of, well, number one, it seems like they're is a lot of fresh vegetables available, and lots of dark leafy greens and lots of seafood and fish available as well in the cuisine. Is that actually where you live? I don't know where exactly you're at.
Yeah.
Is that the case as well?
Yeah, I'm right across from Hong Kong. I'm in Shenzhen. So it's a lot of Guangdong food. So yeah, a lot of fish, leafy greens. When I hear about these food deserts in some places where they just have no access to real food, and just only packaged, processed, convenience store stuff, man, I'm not sure how many places in China have that situation. Like, I went back to my wife's hometown a few weeks ago, sort of my one time a year where I take a training break and I kind of deload and decondition and get out of shape a little bit, just almost for like a mental break as well as physical. Her mom is a really good cook, so she made us food, and she's like, oh, we grew this as well, and it was really good. It was like, it was better than most restaurants, and or any restaurant, I should say, any restaurant. Mom's cooking, you gotta, you know, any restaurant. And so a lot of people, yeah, some people grow their own food. Or if not, it's locally, you know, right down the road or somewhere nearby. And so, and a lot of it is not wasted either. Like chicken feet sounds like a ridiculous thing to eat to most people from Western country. But man, a lot of people here, they love them. Actually, I think quite a few chicken feet are shipped from the US to China because they're not consumed.
that's really very funny.
So it's just it's that's what trade's all about, right? I don't want it, you want it, I want something else, and so, you know, there we go. And then organ meats as well. Like when I was first getting into weightlifting in like 2015, 16, I would cook a lot of my own food because I was counting calories and I was super strict with things. And occasionally I would go out to like restaurants and stuff, but it's just so hard to count calories, and I was trying to be really strict with things. I'm way less relaxed about things now. So maybe it doesn't matter as much, but I think it's a good experience to sometimes go through to count and be strict with things and to get a feel for how much is 500 calories worth of food. A lot of people they think a burger is like 200 calories or something. It's like, okay, that's 1,000 or more. And so I was counting really strictly, and I was making a lot of my own food. So I go to the supermarket and I would look around for various meats and see what was on sale and that kind of stuff. And beef heart, really good. Really good macros, good micros, delicious as well, really easy to cook, pretty cheap as well. And so you got to be careful though about what, because my Chinese was not very good back then. And so I didn't I didn't know what it was. So I was like, this looks, that's a heart. Okay, cool. But I also definitely got something that I think was some kind of bladder.
Oh, interesting. And, okay. Yeah, maybe not so delicious. Good
word. The apartment smelled really weird for a few days.
Well, no, I love a heart, beef and chicken heart, liver. Those are definitely some of my favorites. And here in South America as well, they love cooking nose to tail. Yeah. Always say that, and especially in soup. Right. So you can find literally anything, but it tastes absolutely delicious. And as you said, it's super healthy, and in most cases, very good micronutrient profile. I absolutely love that. But yeah, my question to you, because I get that often where people are like, oh, do you really think the U.S. mostly, or is in particular a place where we're suffering from that higher obesity rates because of being more sedentary and because of more processing? Do you see a difference between that in the U.S. and in China, or is it kind of like approaching in China and in Asia in general to become more in that way as well?
Yeah, so I've been here about, 14 years or so. And so I've definitely noticed a certain rounding out of the population, I would say. Particularly, I was a teacher for many years. And so every year there was, and sometimes I would teach, middle school, sometimes it was high school. But yeah, every year, and it's a little bit hard to tell it every year, but definitely over the course of several years, I noticed an increase in obesity, I would say. There's definitely more of a social stigma about it here, I would say. Like, fat shaming is definitely a thing, for sure, which I don't think is good, but it's sometimes effective. I don't agree with it, but it certainly is motivation for some people. I don't think it's the right motivation, but certainly that could contribute. But a lot of it is just modernization, and most of the fast food restaurants in America are here as well. Mm-hmm. And they're very popular. KFC, McDonald's, and Starbucks, they're everywhere. They're everywhere. And then people are moving less as we just live a technologically advanced lifestyle. So the gym, like the concept of a gym, is somewhat newish here. I mean, I would say there's probably 2, 3, 4 times as many gyms now as when I first got to China. Probably at least 4 times as many. Before, trying to find a gym was you had to walk a while, whereas here you can stand in one place and see a few. And that's kind of just a natural reaction, I think, to our daily lives not really requiring that. So we took that out and we had to put it back in, right? And so I think a lot of those problems that America has have kind of been, I wouldn't say maybe not exported to the rest of the world, but the rest of the world is kind of going along the same path. And then a lot of multinational corporations are kind of feeding that as well, no pun intended.
Yeah, I would agree with that from what I observe, like when I go back over to Europe to visit family and so on. I do think generally, overall speaking, the European countries, or even here as well, it is more pedestrian friendly, or more forced to be pedestrian set up. So you often have to go to the market. There is no parking nearby, or there is no drive through for this and that. And so people are a little bit more forced to be active in their day-to-day lives. That for one. And the other thing that I do still notice as well, even though the availability of fast food restaurants and fast food meals in general is increasing as well, I do think that portion sizes are still small as well. Whereas, of course, you can find a restaurant where they like fully pile up on the plate. But generally speaking, if I go somewhere for breakfast or so, it's smaller, even visible in the size of the drinks. Like my coffee might be like a hand, like I don't know, 3 inches higher, whatever. You can't even get anything larger than venti. That's like the biggest, and that's almost unheard of. So portions are still smaller. That's kind of what I see here anyway.
Yeah, no, for sure. My parents still live in the U.S., and so, yeah, I've seen that where, you know, they might go to a restaurant and split an appetizer, and it's enough sometimes there, because the plates are just, I mean, it's incredible, whereas here, yeah, everything is shrunk down and a lot more reasonable. And so, yeah, maybe America could do with some shrinkflation just to reduce the portion sizes and thus the waistlines. And so, yeah, it's, and that's a bit hard to take away because a lot of people have grown accustomed to those portion sizes. And then you have the surgeries where they're cutting the stomachs, the gastric. And so it's rough, especially if you grew up with that. You know, your whole childhood was just much food, and it's kind of hard to stop. And so, yeah, you see some drastic situations where people are getting the surgeries or they're taking various drugs like Ozempic or anything like that, just because it's this reaction to an extreme, right? You have the extreme on the way up, and then you have to do something extreme on the way down. And so, yeah, it's a bit sad to see. I think Europe probably also has more regulations from what I've seen in terms of at least food labels, but probably other things as well.
I would say so in terms of ingredients and so on, for sure. And yeah, you touched on gyms, so I kind of want to transition a little bit into more the muscle gaining, since that's especially what you're specializing in with Verity Fit. So for the people listening, or maybe even for your average client, let's say, what would be some like five top muscle gaining tips if someone's already in the gym, they're just kind of doing their own thing, not really seeing the progress that they want? What do you think they're doing wrong, or what could they be doing better?
Yeah, so I would say, I don't know if I'll get to five. It might be more, it might be less. I'll just sort of start.
Fine, you go.
And lose count with these kind of things, especially when it's off the dome. I would say learning biomechanics is quite useful. And I said on a recent podcast, and I said something along the lines of like, I don't put that much trust in science, but I use biomechanics. To me, they're almost like different things. Obviously, biomechanics is under the umbrella of science, the science of movement, of biology. But I would say know the function of a muscle that you're trying to train, because that will allow you to train it better. Even if you're doing a compound movement and you're not isolating, if you know the chest is doing this, you're probably going to get more out of whatever you're doing. And so, yeah, I would say learning biomechanics, at least the very, very basics, is very, very important. Because you might say, oh, the biceps, it flexes the elbow. And then you see someone curling, and then they're kind of doing this, and they're not, the elbow's not actually moving, because in the bottom position, they're all the way leaned forward and their elbows are still bent. And in the top, they're leaned back and their elbows are still bent, right? Or someone's doing an upright row and they're leaned forward, and then they're sort of just hinging almost, or using a lot of spine. And so once you learn biomechanics, it's almost like the code to the matrix, because you look around and you just see it everywhere. Like, you just see the way someone is moving when they're benching, and you can tell, okay, they would get more out of it if they move this way, or if they depress their shoulders, or if they, you know, used a little bit less range of motion, more range of motion, or if you see someone squatting and they're like, yeah, I'm trying to work on my quads, and kind of think to yourself, well, a lot of stuff working, quads are pretty down, deep down on the list. And so I would say learning biomechanics is a big one. Learning how to control the weight is a big one, but that doesn't necessarily mean slowly. When a lot of people think or hear control, they often think, oh, I need to move really slowly, I need to control the weight. I would say if you look at a lot of really, really highly skilled lifters, they don't necessarily move slowly, but there is still a great deal of control. I mean, if you look at, say, Olympic weightlifting, which is not hypertrophy focused, they are still controlling the weight, even though they're moving extremely explosively. If Usain Bolt is running 100 meters, he's controlled because he's done it many, many times, and he has a very high level of skill with that movement, with sprinting. And so the same thing with hypertrophy training. If you're doing a curl, you should be controlling the weight. It doesn't necessarily need to be like a 5 or 6 second eccentric, but you should feel the muscles doing something on the way down, and then you should feel them doing something on the way up. And if you can't, that's okay, but it might take a few years in order to develop those skills with various movements, right? So anyone who's like, training is super simple. Well, no, there's a lot of layers to it, right? I would say also learning how to push yourself hard and train really close to failure is quite useful. You probably don't need to fail to build muscle, but I still say a very close proximity to failure is quite important. And it's one of those things where there was a recent study that said, oh, 7 reps in reserve is totally fine. And if you talk to most high level lifters who built up quite a bit of muscle, they'll see that study and usually think like, okay, well, something's weird there, because whether it's 1 or 2 in reserve or whether it's 0 reserve or failure, most people are pretty close who have built up quite a lot of muscle. And so, yeah, biomechanics, the technique, the control, and then the effort. And I would say probably programming, where you know how to disperse the stress throughout the week, right? I see a lot of programs where I can tell it just is not going to go that well based on their exercise order, or, oh, they're doing this exercise here, and then 2 days later they have this exercise. They're most likely not going to be recovered, so they should probably bump this to here. But this is also quite individual, right? Different people recover at different rates. Some people can hit a muscle group 3 or 4 times a week and be totally fine. Some people more like 1 to 2. It also depends on not just each person, but each muscle group as well as each movement that is being trained. Like for me, I recover quite well, but my hamstrings, I need to just leave them alone sometimes and let them recover, because they get a little bit more sore easily. And so, again, this is where knowing yourself and trial and error and then tweaking things, I think, is really important. And that's the fourth one, I think. And then I guess the fifth one would be just enjoy it and be optimistic. I see a lot of people that are like, oh, gotta go to the gym. What? How? Okay, you're doing something wrong. So if you feel like you're dragging your feet to get there, or you're not hopping out of bed and you're not excited about it, I think there's something wrong. And that might be getting a coach, that might be changing your plan, that might be maybe doing something extreme, right? Like, I'm into moderation, but if extreme stuff, you know, challenge workouts or doing like the latest CrossFit thing or anything like that, if it gets you fired up and motivated, that's going to be much more important than, oh, is it optimal, or is it based in science, or is there a study on it, that kind of thing, or did someone else do it, right? So, you know, if doing Arnold's extreme high volume plan gets a 16-year-old kid fired up, I mean, I might look at that plan and be like, oh, what the heck is this? But if he's excited, if he's eating enough, if he's being consistent and working hard, he's probably going to get pretty good results.
I love all of your 5 tips. I think they're really, really great, especially that last one is often overlooked, and what's optimal is emphasized over what's really more enjoyable or what the individual can and wants to adhere to long term. I think that's so, so important. I mean, it's an hour of self-care or more that we get to just zone out and be in our own little bubble for a little while. So I'm with you. I don't know when people don't enjoy or do stuff that they don't enjoy during that time, like why? I mean, yeah, we all have days where we're not as motivated or we're not feeling it. And like, that's normal. You just show up anyway. But aside from that, the finding something that you generally feel joy about, I think, is really, really important. But nonetheless, speaking of kind of like optimization, et cetera, what's your opinion on machines versus free weight?
Yeah, I think both are fine. I used to be, man, my perspective on training has evolved quite a bit over the years. I mean, I used to be the guy who would see someone doing a squat in a Smith machine and just be like, this guy, he's not working his stabilizers. He doesn't know about the stabilizers. I know about the stabilizers. This guy doesn't, he's an idiot. And it actually, it took getting injured. I tore my QL on one side, and it was actually a really good year of leg training overall, even though it took like 10 months to finally heal. I kept being overly aggressive with trying to get back to the movements I wanted to do. But it was a really good year of lower body training, because I had to kind of find ways to stress the legs without putting a lot of force through the lower back. And so it turns out I'd actually probably been doing a lot of lower body movements using too much lower back, or just hinging a lot, using a lot of hips. Because you can often squat in a way that kind of avoids the quads to a certain extent. Like, there's always knee extension going on. Like, so I'm not saying there's no quads involved, right? But if you take like a wide stance, you sit re really far back, you use low bar, you let the torso go forward. This is where I see people say stuff like, this guy squats 600 pounds and his legs aren't that big. Well, and then you look at him squat the 600 pounds, it's like, okay, well, that makes sense. His knees went forward that much. And it's almost impressive how little quad they got out of the squat. The issue is when someone who wants big quads tries to copy that style of squat, and that's sort of what I was doing. And so it took the injury, which did not allow me to move that way anymore. And so, okay, let's try a machine, or let's try a leg press with my feet really low on the pad so that the knees go up and it keeps the tension in the quads, right? Or, all right, that Smith machine, I can see there are some benefits there. Okay, like, I'll move my feet a little forward and it'll take the hips and lower back a little bit out of it. And, oh, this actually feels kind of good. Like, maybe I was wrong about that, right? And so, yeah, I think machines, as I evolved, I kind of looked at like free weights, and then you can, oh, now you can maybe supplement them with machines, right? Now I kind of look at them as just equal but different, right? Where maybe free weights are a little bit more technical, and they might require a little bit of a longer investment in terms of getting the technique down and really progressing them. And so, yeah, if you want to just get in a nice quick workout, like a plate loaded machine is just, it's going to be quicker than warming up on the bench press or something, right? And so, yeah, if you're really pushed for time, a machine might be faster, but a free weight might hit more muscles, right? Like, if you're really pressed for time and you care about strength, okay, like, one set of deadlifts can get you pretty far. As long as it's hard, you're hitting a huge amount of muscle mass that no machine in the world is going to replicate, right? Or maybe you have a home gym and you have a limited number of machines that you can get, or maybe no machines at all. And so, yeah, I kind of just look at them as different options. And ultimately, it's just about putting tension and stress on the muscle. And I think both can do a really good job of doing that.
Awesome. Yeah, I had a unfortunately a similar experience or a similar mindset at first when it came to machines are for, you know, like we don't use them, we're too good for machines type of thing, and then get an injury and only then learning, oh, this is amazing, I can actually target specific things so much better. So yeah, you live and you learn. But I love how you put that with equal but different. And I guess a follow-up question sort of would be about that whole debate on rep ranges, like what's really a good hypertrophy range, so to speak, if there is something like that. Is it the old 8 to 12? What's the research saying, or what's your opinion?
Yeah, so the research, it's kind of showing roughly 5 to 35. I've seen, as long as you're equally close to failure, 5 to 35. Now you might say 5 to 35. That's a really big range. I think most people, my sort of go-to would be a double progression. So let's say you pick a like an 8 to 10 or an 8 to 12, and you try to get to the top of the rep range. And then when you do, you add weight, which will reduce your reps. And then you kind of just build up and up. So you build up the reps, then you build up the weight, then you build up the reps, then you build up the weight. I would say there's been a recent, and I haven't made a video about this, I might though, there's been a recent trend of people doing quite low reps. We're talking like sets of 4 to 5 to maybe 6. And this is sort of the idea that you only really benefit from the last few reps in a set anyway, the effective quote unquote reps, right? Usually it's the last 5, which kind of shows you that's shaky ground, right? Right. Why not 4? Why not 6? Why not the last 3 reps? Why not the last 7? Like, why is it only the last 5 reps? Is it the last 5 for a beginner as well as someone who's really advanced? Is that totally the same? Is it the last 5 on every single exercise, right? Is something that's stretch focused or contraction focused, every single muscle group? So yeah, I think the effective reps model, just like any model, is not perfect. It's useful. I think it's a good way of thinking about things in some ways. Right, like, is that fifth to last rep the same as the last rep? Are they those completely equal in terms of stimulus? Could you do 5 sets where you ended at 5 reps early, and this is the same as 1 set where it's totally different? So, yeah, I think it's maybe a little bit simplistic, and it's just so easy to poke holes in that theory. I think that if someone likes training heavy, then it's fine. I notice that often it's younger guys promoting this kind of training where it's really heavy and they have young joints, and it's maybe they'll feel differently in 5 years or 10 years. And I'm not fear mongering or saying like you'll get injured from doing your sets of 5. But if you talk to guys who have been at it for, or girls, you know, who've been at it for 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, maybe they're getting a little up there in years as well as mileage on the body, and they've spent thousands of hours in the weight room, none of them do only sets of 5 or under. Like, none of them. It's just, I don't think I've ever met anyone who's like, yep, 5 reps, I'm done. I always go heavy all the time. No, it's just not particularly sustainable. Now, I get the appeal, because a set of 10 or a set of 15 is a different kind of uncomfortable. I think, especially younger guys, yeah, like they're willing to get under some heavy weight, but they might not be as willing to do a set of 15 in the leg press, right? Especially if conditioning is an issue. And that might be a draw, right? Like if your cardiovascular system gives out when you do a set of walking lunges, yeah, it might not be as good of a hypertrophy stimulus. But I would also say that to those people, don't you want to be strong in terms of your cardiovascular system, right? It's almost like it's showing a weakness, and then they're running away from the weakness by doing only really low reps, right? And so I would say, okay, maybe you can do your low reps, but then also a mixture of high reps as well, right? And this is where I think it's been shown that a mixture of rep ranges is actually better than just sticking to one rep range, right? So if you've been doing, and this might change over time, right? Maybe you've been doing a lot of sets of 5, and then you mix it up and you do a little bit higher reps for a time, right? And you might find that some exercises are kind of just a no-fly zone for really low reps or really high reps, right? Like I can't imagine doing a dumbbell lateral raise for a set of 4. Like I just don't see how that would be productive for me personally. Now, maybe some people, they can hold technique really, really well, and they feel like they're getting a lot out of it. But for me, I can tell it's just not doing very much. But for other movements, yeah, I think low reps for me are totally fine, or high reps. And so it does take quite a bit of personal experimentation. And if someone says, hey, I did low reps, or I did high reps and I got really good results, like, that's the proof. That's the proof that it's working. So yeah, it does take an individual approach.
Yeah, I like how we're kind of like going full circle here, as to the first thing that we spoke about with the personalization and individualization with nutrition, but some really great tips. And I personally also like the notion of having a variety of rep ranges, just for it makes us things up. You don't have to stick with exactly 8 to 10, like for exercises, exactly like you're saying, where you prefer higher reps, like by all means. So yeah, love the tips, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for your time. It's been honestly a true pleasure speaking with you. Of course, I will make sure to link your social handles and your website and so on in the show notes. I truly appreciate you speaking to us at that late hour of the day for you over in China. It's past 10 o'clock. So thank you so much. And yeah, it's been a pleasure. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jeff. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.